The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africa Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Why it is that South African wine doesn't command the big premiums that many other great wines from other parts of the world command. My guest tonight will give us some insight on that. We'll talk about the platinum price fall and what impact that has had on the JSE today, which has seen a very strong rally in the rand as well. Dr. Ryan Noach standing by. We'll chat to him about the consequences of missing government's 70% vaccination target by Christmas, and the best bits and the brutal biz quiz still to come on this evening's edition of The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Bear with me, just bear with me for a moment while we put the elections to bed. I'm sure you're as fatigued by them as we are, but they are important, and I promise not to dwell on the micro issues, but there are some big issues just to wrap up on. Mpumelelo Mkabela is a political analyst and joins us on the line from Johannesburg this evening. Mpumelelo, good evening to you. Welcome to The Money Show. The ANC, by far still the most popular party in the country, 161 councils where it's got a majority. The DA has got a majority in 13, the IFP in 10, and we've got 66 hung municipalities. But is the ANC popular enough for Cyril Ramaphosa to keep his job?
Good evening, Bruce. President Cyril Ramaphosa will keep his job in the meantime. However, it is clear that the task that lies ahead for him is quite huge, because these elections, which saw its support base nationally going below 50%, will inevitably sharpen the spears of all those who have always wanted a weapon to knife him. You know, in the ANC, he has always had his enemies through what is called the Radical Economic Transformation Grouping. So this might arm them. And they've already started, people like Kanye House, already agitating to say this is a referendum for a vote of no confidence against the president. Yet we know very well that these were elections that had to do with the competence of the ANC in various municipalities. And if it was a referendum, it's a referendum on how poorly this ANC has been doing in delivering services to communities.
Yep, the ANC has done poorly at that. What's also happened in these elections is the fact that opposition parties, the bigger ones, the main official opposition and the EFF, have failed to capitalize on those weaknesses of the ANC. Do we see leadership changes coming there? We've seen precedent, certainly within the DA, for punishing underperformance, and there has been on 2016 underperformance there. And the EFF, while it has grown its support since 2016, hasn't shot the lights out as some would have believed it might.
Well, I would say, Bruce, the major failure of all the political parties, including the opposition parties, has been to get voters to vote. I mean, about 70% of South Africans that are eligible to vote didn't vote. And I'm including here people that were registered and those that did not register, but nevertheless, they fall within the suffrage limit. They didn't vote. So that's a failure of all the political parties, and that's where they could have capitalized, because it's very clear that this disgruntlement against the ANC for its failure is quite enormous. So people responded by staying away, which means that the opposition parties didn't do enough to demonstrate that they can actually do better.
That is almost more concerning than anything else in this in these elections. Where does it leave Jacob Zuma and his apparent influence? He's been trading on his influence for a very, very long time. That influence does seem to be waning fast.
The reality, Bruce, is that Jacob Zuma is no longer a factor in the future of South African politics. In any way, to the extent that he's the future, It began in 2009 with the decline of the ANC, and it's an acceleration that we are seeing right now. However, other than that, he's no longer the future. He planted the seeds of the decline, and that's it. So the issue now for the Cyril Ramaphosa and the future leadership of the ANC is whether they can stop that decline by improving the way they govern, where they still have influence, either through coalitions or where they've got outright majorities. And the next step is whether they can win the 2024 elections convincingly. Because it seems to me, Bruce, that these elections are signaling a transition of our politics away from the dominance of the ANC, where power was held tightly within the ANC, to a more diffused political power. So your listeners in business, for example, might no longer have to focus only on the ANC when they lobby for better policies. They have to look wider now.
Yeah, and that is going to play out, I suppose, over the weekend as we start seeing the horse trading and the negotiations begin.
Indeed, Bruce. So what you will see now is the complexity of the negotiations that are going to happen now as various political parties try to cobble together some coalition. The complexity is that it's many municipalities, unprecedented number, that are hung this time around. And if you try to put together a coalition in Johannesburg or Tshwane or Etegwini or any of the other municipalities that are hung, your opponents that you are negotiating with to put together a government will remind you of another municipality where they also might need support, your support to govern there. So the horse trading this time around is going to be very tough, very complex, and one can only hope that whoever takes over, whoever agrees to share power, they actually do so and they all take over the government, unlike in the past in Johannesburg and Tshwane, where the EFF was wielding power, but negative power, in a sense that they refused to be part of the government. So whatever was happening in Tshwane and Johannesburg, of which they were actually part, but they wouldn't take accountability because they would say, but they're not part of government. Yet they were part of collapsing this government by the mere positions of their voting power.
You've got to hope that we've learned the lessons of those failed coalitions from the past. Thank you, Mpumelelo Mgabela. Great analysis there this evening on elections 2021. Done and dusted. Don't need to talk about them again for a while.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The far more serious, frankly, is the low vaccination rate in the country, because that has lots of follow-on consequences. And deep research by Discovery finding that we are not likely to reach government's target of 70% of the adult population vaccinated by Christmas. Dr. Ryan Noach, Chief Executive at Discovery Health. Are we going to get anywhere close, do you think, Ryan?
We predict that we'll to around 50%. Good evening, Bruce.
And what is the consequence of 50 versus 70%?
A whole lot more illness and mortality, unfortunately, if we end up facing a fourth wave. And even if we don't go through a fourth wave, unfortunately, you know, we live with COVID-19 now as an endemic disease, which means that there's a baseline infection rate right throughout the community. And with morbidity and mortality associated as a result of a high unvaccinated population.
How do we get vaccines done? We see huge hesitancy, huge reluctance. Some companies and individuals in trying to incentivize staff and colleagues to get themselves vaccinated. We don't seem to be ready yet to pull the trigger on tough love.
Yeah, I think it's very important to spread the facts and to deal with the misinformation out there. The misinformation is everywhere, and it's causing a lot of fear and anxiety and hesitation. And it's really very hard to understand why there's such a strong anti-vaccine lobby when the data is so clear. I'm talking about data from South Africans like you and I, diverse representation right across all race and gender throughout the South African population, and our own data from people around us is just unequivocal. On the one hand, it's safe, and on the other hand, it's highly effective at preventing severe illness and disease and death.
We're seeing, for example, people in the UK behaving like there is no pandemic, and the rate of infections has ratcheted up very, very substantially in the last couple of weeks, and they're getting huge numbers of infections coming through. What we're not seeing, though, is deaths as a result of COVID-19. And I think that then further backs up your assertion of the efficacy of the vaccines.
Yes, the UK has been quite proactive, quite progressive in its release of social distancing measures and mask wearing. As a result, there's a large amount of disease that's being spread amongst the population. But to use the NHS's terminology, they've seen a delinkage, a break in the link between infection patterns and then severely compromised individuals. So while they are seeing hospital admissions, they're seeing much fewer and much fewer deaths. And if you follow the media around Europe at the moment, particularly from today out of Spain and Trieste in Italy, the commentators are talking about a wave of unvaccinated illness, unvaccinated individuals with severe illness that are flooding their hospitals and overwhelming them, particularly in the Trieste context, which is very interesting.
And concerning as well, because we do know that there's nothing that a virus likes more than mutating and trying to stay one step or 20 steps or 5,000 steps ahead of the scientists. And the more people who remain unvaccinated, the more this thing is allowed to spread, the more it is likely to mutate to something that we really don't want to see.
Yes, absolutely. And mutation happens particularly when the virus survives for a long time in a host. So in immune-compromised populations like South Africa, where unfortunately we live with high rates of HIV and TB and a lot of immune compromise, the virus has been shown to survive for a much longer period in those hosts. And those long survivals tend to be what leads to mutation. I think the optimistic side of the mutation, and I'm no expert on this, but I'm told by the country's leading virologists, that viruses mutate to try and survive. That's the reason for mutation. And so hopefully what we will see in future mutations, and this is not a prediction but more of a hope, is we'll see that the mutations are to become more contagious but less virulent. In other words, to cause less disease but spread more easily. And you can understand if you're a virus, that's exactly what you want to do. You want your host to survive and you want to be able to spread to more hosts. And that's how these viruses tend to evolve as per the virologists.
Yeah, I mean, I think the outlook, we understand it far better now than we did 12, 18 months ago, and that's positive. There's also now Pfizer with an experimental antiviral pill. It's called Paxlovid or something like that. And it's a pill, an antiviral pill, and it's cutting hospitalizations and death from COVID by nearly 90%. Have you got any insight as to when we might be able to get a pill to take rather than a jab?
No insight as to when we're going to get access, but a huge amount of excitement around particularly the evidence that was released today. I think what's good news is that this is a medication that's not new to healthcare at all. It's a protease inhibitor, which is how it works as an antiviral agent. And these have been around for some time. Which means that, hopefully the approvals happen much faster and we understand much more about the medication as opposed to a completely novel medicine to the market. The evidence looks compelling, Bruce, as you say. It's for use in early COVID-19 in people who are at high risk of severe complications, ideally out of hospital. They say within 3 to 5 days after an infection or roughly as you test positive. And it has an 89% reduction in severe complications from COVID-19 in those groups. So this is very positive. And our team is certainly immediately trying to find out how we can gain access as quickly as possible. No doubt the country's medicine regulator, SAHPRA, will be on to this.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Dr. Ryan Noach, Chief Executive at Discovery Health. Vaccinations, vaccinations, and more vaccinations is what we need, but we're not going to get anywhere close to a level that is going to give protection, significant enough protection, from a level 4 vaccine, a level 4 wave, and a fourth wave of COVID-19. Does it mean more lockdowns, more bans, more the fun police coming out? I hope not, but I suspect we could be headed that way unless we somehow manage to convince more people to get an injection that could help stop the spread or slow the spread of COVID-19.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Philanthropy is a bit of a double-edged sword. The money does great work, but it can often be used by some philanthropists as a way of whitewashing their past. I've recently read the story of the Sacker family, an empire of pain, and how one of America's richest dynasties has basically tried to buy favor with massive philanthropy after generations of unethical business practice. And that can make you quite cynical about philanthropy. But South Africa has got quite a young and very vibrant philanthropic industry, which through COVID's been absolutely critical at keeping disaster at bay for many. We saw some of South Africa's richest families, for example, donate billions to the Solidarity Fund to help the country's response to the disaster of the pandemic. And thank goodness for that money. I'm sure that it alleviated a huge burden that would otherwise have swamped the health system far more severely than it did. Now, a group of prominent philanthropic organizations, the Ackerman Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and several others are saying we need to think differently about philanthropy into the future. So often what happens is you get people with lots of money and a big idea on what problems they'd like to solve, and they impose their solutions on communities and groups of people. Well, the Springbok rugby captain Siya Kolisi and his wife Rachel are co-founders of the Kolisi Foundation, and they've added their voice to a really interesting appeal when it comes to philanthropy in South Africa. And Rachel Kolisi on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. Thanks for making time, Rachel. I mean, I wonder if what we are seeing is more and more philanthropy beginning to understand precisely what it is that communities need, rather than just going in the old-fashioned way and imposing charity. Are you seeing a change in thinking?
Hi, yes, firstly, thank you so much for having me on. I must say the 2 days that I spent in that room was just so unbelievable, and just so much information shared, so much wisdom shared on those 2 days. And you know, I actually on the panel I spoke about it. You know, there's an old way I think of philanthropy, the way that philanthropy has been working, and I think that they have a lot of wisdom. They've got a lot of mistakes that were made, a lot of good things that were done, and there's almost like a new wave of philanthropy coming through now, especially, you know, after seeing the results of COVID and how it's affected so many of our communities. And this new wave of philanthropy almost has a new way of doing things. But I just think that, you know, for us personally with the Kolisi Foundation, we love to learn, we love to listen, we love to understand. So we do have our ways of doing things, but it was such an incredible opportunity to learn from those foundations who have been, you know, in the game, if you will, for so many years, and really could just understand what they did right, what they did wrong.
And the one of the big things is by imposing your will on a community that may have fundamentally far deeper and more difficult issues to deal with than you can even comprehend as an outsider. And I think that is the big learning from this gathering that you were part of over 2 days, that people have wised up a little bit to, hold on a second, perhaps we can treat communities more respectfully, frankly, than perhaps we have in the past.
Absolutely. And, it's beyond even respect. It's this idea of dignity. It's this idea of humanity that is so vital. And, you know, this whole idea of, like, let me come in and be a savior in your community, that just has to be, in my opinion, scrapped completely. Because we have no business going into somebody else's home, somebody else's living environment, and telling them what they should do to make things better or to live differently. It's just so important, I feel, for people to be going into communities that maybe they are not, you know, from, or that they know, and really just spend time learning, understanding. And you know what's been so surprising for us is really just spending time in some of the communities and realizing how many small organizations are doing the work on a daily basis but are under-resourced and really just don't have a platform to work from to get the word out of the amazing work that they're doing. And so that's something that we're really intentional about, is partnering with some of these organizations who are on the ground every day, who do understand the community's needs and how things are run.
It's so important, and really getting to grassroots. But in that process, I suppose one's got to do a really careful audit of those organizations to make sure that the money is spent in the way that the organisations say that it will. Because unfortunately, you know, when there's money about it, it creates opportunity for individuals to take advantage.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, that it goes without saying that that's in every single organization, because, you know, we know of some top dogs in our country who are doing some dodgy things as well and wheeling and dealing in financial things that maybe they shouldn't be. But yes, it is an absolute important part of the work to make sure that you are auditing and that the money is going where it needs to go and the work is getting done. We've never had an issue of any kind when it comes to kind of the financial backing that we are able to do, and that's simply because, you know, a lot of the organizations that we've partnered with they've been around for years. You know, the soup kitchens, for example, they've been soup kitchens for years before COVID, during COVID, and after COVID, they will continue to do their work. So, a lot of the organizations that have been around and doing the work for years already and are just able to amplify that work so much more now and with a little bit more backing.
Thank you, Rachel Khuleesi, co-founder of the Khuleesi Foundation, this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Let me tell you what's happened on markets today. Just give you a quick wrap-up, and that is the fact that US and European and UK, because they're separate now, markets have been very, very strong today, actually. There's been a very strong rally, and we saw US employment numbers improve quite dramatically in October, much better than expected, and there was a bit of a slowdown in the Northern Hemisphere summer. But what we saw in October was firms in the US adding 531,000 new jobs, and the unemployment rate back down to 4.6%. And so we've seen some pretty good hiring happening in the US, much better than expected. And the spread of the Delta variant, slower growth, already did harm the summer hiring period, I suppose, as you could look at it like that. But today's jobs numbers were much better than expected, and that's given a boost to US markets this evening. What's been surprising over the last couple of days is just how resilient the Rand has been. We look at the Rand this evening around 20.38 to the pound. It is 21 at the beginning of this week, and there was a mixture, I suppose, of worries about whether the Fed would start talking more aggressively about raising interest rates. They didn't, and they talked about tapering and taking money out of the financial system on Wednesday. We also saw the Bank of England decide yesterday to not raise interest rates. They want to ensure that economy is quite tough and resilient, and as a result, we are seeing the Rand on something of a tear. I'm wondering whether or not this market is looking at the currency and saying the Reserve Bank is going to have to raise interest rates. We're seeing many developing markets, despite the fact that there's very little demand in many of these economies, there is outside pressure coming through as a result of energy costs in particular, whether it be gas or whether it be electricity. And we're seeing many smaller economies really, really struggling. So we've seen some fairly aggressive interest rate increases in many parts of the world. I hope it doesn't come yet. I hope we can avoid it because there's enough pressure and taking money out of your pocket as it is. The currency is encouraging tonight. I look at it at 20.33 to the pound. To the euro, we're sitting at 17.42, and the dollar right now at 15.07. It's quite a dramatic improvement on this Friday afternoon.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Lots of stories around wine doing the rounds at the moment. The wine industry looking for government support. The wine industry, of course, taken a huge knock during COVID-19 and the lockdowns and all of the difficulties that they faced. There's also another big issue in wine. And I am hoping that Mike Ratcliffe, who is our guest this evening and is going to be able to help inform us in terms of what's going on in terms of the ability of South African wineries to charge premium prices for their premium wines in premium markets in the way that many other great producers are able to do from all over the world. We've got a bit of a brand problem in terms of some South African wine. Also, coming up on the next Money Show, we're going to be doing our regular book review feature, and that is with the specialist at Flux Trends, Bronwyn Williams, who's going to be reviewing a book for us called Seeing Like a State. Then Toby Shapshak, Tech with Toby, looking at reviews of the latest gadgets that you can find online and in tech stores, plus, of course, other people's money. We'll find somebody fabulous. somebody fabulous to tell you all of their deepest and darkest and most personal secrets about money.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Now, the idea of the Friday File, of course, is to find luxury, to talk about luxury as a Friday treat, a bit like Business Day's Wanted magazine, just with words instead of pictures. Mike Ratcliffe, co-founder and managing partner at Villafonte, on the line to us this evening. You've come from a long line of winemakers. Your mum and dad, of course, famously the owners of Warwick, and I think a couple of years ago sold to American investors, if memory serves, Mike.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. You're right on the money. That's exactly what happened.
How are the new owners coping? Are they maintaining the standards? Are they keeping up the brand equity of the mighty Warwick with the trilogy and the three Cape ladies and the blue lady and the white lady and all the other ladies?
I do watch it with a keen eye, and it seems like they've got their finger on the pulse. But a wise woman, my mother, once told me that if you sell something, walk away.
Don't be influenced. You started Villafonte long before your mum, the family sold out of Warwick. I mean, this has been your project for, I think, 20 years or so.
Yeah, actually, next year is the 25th anniversary of the planting of Villafonte. But I've actually only been involved for just over 20 years. And it's been a remarkable journey working with two exceptional partners from California. It's been really eye-opening and mind-boggling, a journey just that.
What's the American tie-up? What is the your apparent association with America? American buyers at Warwick and your tie-up with Villafonte and Americans now?
I think it's actually coincidental, but my American partners that I started Villafonte with together all those years ago are just two highly passionate, highly skilled people deeply involved in the wine industry. They were connected with Mondavi and the famous Opus One, and they just saw great potential in South Africa and wanted to invest into South Africa, and we've been active partners ever since. It's been a wonderful ride.
And, I mean, your property, Villafonte, sits in the Paarl area. And Villafonte refers to the soil. I think that's what the name means, doesn't it? It's this particular kind of soil. It's a Hutton. It's a Villafonte. I don't know. Explain to me.
Well, actually, that's what attracted my American partners to South Africa. They realized that we live in the cradle of humankind. Southern Africa is the oldest soils in the world. And they were intrigued to see what would happen if you took the greatest, most classic varieties in the world and stuck them into the oldest dirt in the world. And that's what we did. And I guess the proof is in the pudding.
So that then comes, or proof is in the wine, really. But I mean, that's, so they, okay, so you call your sort of entry-level wine seriously old dirt. So it's the same grapes from the same vineyards, just treated differently.
Yeah, that's right. We only produce four grapes on our property, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, and Malbec, the classics from Bordeaux. And yeah, we only produce three wines, and all of them are Bordeaux-style blends. So it's a very tight and very focused business. We produce at three different price points and three different quality levels. So it's really easy to understand and explain.
Because you've got seriously old dirt, and then you've got Series C and Series M, and those grapes, and they come from quite a small property. I mean, 42 hectares, I suppose in wine terms, 42 hectares is a lot. It's not like you're producing grain on hundreds of hectares. Is that a comfortable scale for you? I mean, you're getting the sort of volume that you want.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever be defined based on volume. We're always going to be trying to define ourselves based on quality. I think the term that we use is precision viticulture. So everything is done to a level of quality and precision that is some people would consider quite outlandish. The volume that we do produce is sufficient. Although having said that, it sells out, you know, within weeks, which is something that I'm very proud of. But it has taken 25 years in the mines and of hard graft to get there. So nothing in life really comes that easy. It's been hard work.
But you do the Apple thing, don't you? I mean, you do create anticipation. You do sort of advertise weeks ahead of the release of the Series C or the Series M. It's coming. It's a little bit like waiting for the new iPhone.
Yeah, well, I'd love to be in the same position as to have the balance sheet of Apple. We're nowhere in the same business. But yes, our customers are fiercely loyal. We need to tell them what's happening, when it's coming. I do think that, a powerful marketing communication message is really important. But we're silent a lot of the time and we're noisy when we need to be.
You do like awards. You recently, I think it was very recent actually, got Best Red Wine Producer of the Year from the International Wine and Spirit Competition. You're not shy of publicising your awards, where somebody like Emir List, for example, trades on a very successful brand, on the Rubicon brand. You never find a sticker from a competition on a Rubicon bottle, simply because, you know, nobody wants to stick a silver sticker on a great wine. And so some people choose to opt out, but you opt in and opt in quite aggressively. That illustrates, I think, quite a high level of confidence in what you're doing.
Well, actually, it's not entirely true, Bruce. We tend to avoid most of the competitions that are out there, and not because we have anything against competitions. It's just that there comes a time when people have to buy the wine based on intrinsics rather than somebody else's opinion. And of course, we've had the luxury of 25 years to have our customers develop a taste. So we do like to benchmark ourselves globally, and that's where a competition like the International Wine and Spirit Competition is invaluable, because you really are judged. Firstly, you're judged blind, so there's no label involved in any of the tasting. And secondly, it's one of the very few international competitions that the big guns enter. So that's important for us.
And I think you recently traveled to Dubai, where you found your wine in business class on Emirates, the Villafonte Series M in the business class on Emirates. And also, I think, a good showing at Dubai Airport. There were a number of South African wines there. I think there was a Buchanan's Kloof in there. You certainly were there as well. And it's good to see you getting onto those international platforms. Is that hard to do?
I mean, everything in the wine business is generally quite hard. The competition is fierce. There's just so many moving parts at all times. But I think I think we've always had a little bit of a handbrake as a country, because there's been some sort of South African handbrake that we've had to deal with. But what I'm most proud about is how the upper echelon of South African wine seems to have moved past that now, and the rise of the top end of South African wine is something new and something super exciting. But we're starting to see the top 10 or 15 producers compete aggressively and successfully against the best wines in the world and win, which is something wonderful to be part of.
What has changed? Because there was a time where South African wine wasn't getting the rating that it deserved. It wasn't getting the premium it deserved against like-for-like wines elsewhere. It simply wasn't being able to achieve that price point. And people said, well, that's because South Africa exports so much wine in bulk in big popsucks and then bottles on the other side. And it sort of competes with what's not great out of Chile and Romania and places like that. And South Africa's wine brand equity wasn't particularly strong. But something fundamentally has changed.
Yeah, I think there's a new generation that's come through that are extremely willing to experiment. I think that there's a couple of things. The first thing is that regional identity is really starting to develop, where the regions of South Africa are starting to specialize. I also think that there's a newfound confidence. And what I also like is the fact that we are starting to express our cultural identity. You know, the days of Pinotage being everybody's enemy are over. Chenin Blanc is rising to be one of the great varieties of the world. Cinzo is on the up. And these are South African things that South African winemakers and South African people are doing, and they are finding favor with the world. And now the next thing that has to happen is the confidence needs to translate into pricing, because on the international stage, the greatest South African wines still trade at a fraction of international competitors. But, you know, this will happen over time.
And again, just my memory lets me down from time to time. Did you tweet the other day that one of the reasons why we're not getting the price point is because we're not getting the right amount of volume into the market to create the presence in stores more widely, so that we can really then start competing head to head with some of the great global producers?
Yeah, I did. And I stand by that comment. If you look at the greatest wines in the world, many of them are made in significant volume. And, you know, there are many wines in Bordeaux that are trading at 10,000 rand a bottle that are produced in 60,000, even 100,000 case lots. So I'm not suggesting that we need to go that far, but the risk is that if a great 3 or 4 barrels of wine is produced by an incredible winemaker in Stellenbosch, most of that wine will be gobbled up in Cape Town by local wine lovers that may not even get to Joburg, and it risks falling into an area of insignificance. And what I would personally love to see is that these spectacular wines increase in volume so that they can grace the tables in Tokyo and New York and San Francisco, because that's going to be the best way for us to really build brand equity for South African wine.
Is there capacity to do that at many properties? And I wonder if people have been reluctant to invest in that level of production yet have the capacity, or there simply isn't the capacity to do it. What's your view?
I think the capacity is there. I think that the easiest way to do it is to move into an area of focus. A criticism that I have had, and not everybody would agree with me, is that too much of the industry is fragmented. So many wineries are producing 10, 15, 20 wines. And if you ask that winery what they specialize in, they don't actually know. So I think that the next decade will likely be a move towards focus and a move towards specialization. And it'll probably be based on the canvas of regionality.
And we see somebody like Wade Bales, for example, who's collaborating with the best winemakers in the Brede Kloof and in Stellenbosch and in the Constantia Valley, really bringing together the best of those skills. Is that the beginning of something, or is he just having fun?
I think Wade's having fun. He's a very astute businessman. He's got an incredible palate, and I think he is having fun, probably making some money at the same time. But I think that, the winemakers of Himmel and Arda are probably going to take Chardonnay and Pinot Noir to the next level. And I think the winemakers of Stellenbosch are probably going to take Cabernet Sauvignon to the next level. And my belief is similar to what Wade is doing, but on an individual producer basis, specialization based on regionality is going to drive the entire industry going forward, especially at the premium end.
Does Villafonte make money, Mike, or have you just got very patient partners?
We're a very successful business.
That's good to hear, Mike. It really is. Mike Ratcliffe, thank you very much indeed. The co-founder and managing partner at Villafonte on our Friday file this evening. The luxury, the complexity, the technicalities, and the great opportunity of South Africa's wine industry. In a few moments, we'll play the Brutal Biz Quiz. We'd like you to play because it's a little bit boring me playing by myself. I get to win, which is nice, but I'd prefer it if you played and you could win. If inflation is an increase, the rate of inflation of prices and of goods and services, what is the term you use when prices go down? A miracle? No, that's not the word. Is inflation is the increase in prices? What is the term when prices go down? It's not hallelujah or a miracle or about time. It has a more technical term. 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Give us a shout.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
If inflation's the increase in prices, what do you call it when it goes the other way, Rich in Pretoria?
Deflation, Bruce.
Deflation, absolutely right. We're not going to see much deflation anytime soon. And actually, it's not something that you want in an economy. You don't want prices to be coming down because then people wait to buy stuff and ultimately it affects economic growth. You want a little bit of inflation, but we've got inflation building on steroids, potentially. Electricity inflation at 14%, food at 6%, petrol inflation at 34%. It's a little bit scary. Which state-owned enterprise is going to receive funding to help reduce its reliance on coal?
It's got to be Eskom.
It's got to be Eskom. Absolutely right. The president on Tuesday announcing a 131 billion rand concessional climate financing package. Exactly how it's going to work, but it comes from the US and the UK and France and Germany, and may it be quick and may it be spent well. Jess Staley has stepped down as chief executive of which British bank? It had a South African connection.
Say again?
It had a South African connection. It no longer does.
Butleys.
Barclays Bank, Barclay Bank, they used to call it in the olden days. Jess Daly stepped down on Monday. His alliance, friendship with Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein, has raised some eyebrows, and he's very grumpy. What is the name of the Squid Game cryptocurrency, the Squid Game inspired cryptocurrency, which collapsed after a scam?
It's got to be the Squid Crypto.
Nice and short, yeah. Five letters.
Squid.
There we go. Good guess, Rich in Pretoria. Good guess. In 1978, a couple of pharmacists, who were a couple too, Ivan and Lynette Saltzman, founded a pharmacy business. What is that pharmacy business called?
Dis-Chem.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know what, Rich? You've answered so many questions, and you've not given anybody else a turn. But I think you are a worthy wizard, the Biz Quiz, because you're focused and deadly serious. I was going to ask you next. I was going to say to you, which JSE-listed energy company? I think we need to do this, producers, by the way. We need to get hold, please, of Stefano Marani. We've not had him on The Money Show yet. Maybe as a shapeshifter. Let's get him in as a shapeshifter before the end of the year, because he is doing really interesting things. And one of the products that is as a result of gold mining in the Free State is the release of helium. And remember, Virginia, Henneman, Velcom, that part of the world, lots of gold. The gold is largely gone now, but what is emerging from the earth is helium. It used to get burnt off. And now they're going, hold on a second. Renogen is going, hold on a second. No. Catch that, bottle it, and let's send it to the United States. And they've now got a resource which is bigger than they imagined it would be. And we've just seen the share price of Renogen grow stratospheric. I mean, the valuation is nuts. But people are very excited about this discovery of helium, and it's not for party balloons and for breathing in and talking funny. It really is a great resource and is going to be used as an alternative energy, certainly for now in the United States. We'll see what other applications it gets. So Stefano would be a great guest for The Money Show, and I hope we get to speak to him soon. That's it for the first hour of The Money Show. The best bits coming up next. Well done to Rich in Pretoria, the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz. Eyewitness News in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield was brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you award-winning trade and working capital funding solutions to unlock the full potential of your business story. APSA is a registered FSP.